So I don't really understand how, as somebody in London, and obviously not London, Ontario, London, England, actually knows about any of my films outside of vinyl, which I know did, which I did sell to like BBC 3 or 4, and I know people there saw it, but nothing else of mine has sold in England or played in England or played really anywhere much outside of Toronto. So I'm surprised that anybody could quote unquote follow my career who doesn't basically live in Ontario.
Yes, maybe you haven't heard of Alan Zweig's films, but if you have seen one, you have probably gone to great lengths to seek out others. And finding them is no easy feat. Alan's films have not, as he says, traveled outside of his native Canada. The short version of the story is this. Alan started making films 3.5 decades ago, looking to make narrative cinema in the mold of his heroes such as John Cassavetes. For the first 20 or so years of that time, he made 3 short films and a feature that no one saw. Mostly though, Alan found himself skirting the fringes of the Canadian film industry, working as a driver, driving on film sets. He calls this part of his life, 20 odd years of it, a failure. But then, with nothing to lose, he made a documentary that, on the surface at least, was about record collecting. That film looks rough, low budget, with seemingly little attention paid to visual flair. It is composed mostly of interviews. There are jump cuts galore and almost non-stop background music. That film did find an audience. And with that, Alan found himself a documentary filmmaker and a storyteller with a unique voice. He has since directed 6 more documentary features, all of them well received. His 4th, A Hard Name, won the Canadian Genie Award for Best Documentary. His most recent film, Hurt, picked up awards at the Toronto Film Festival and the Canadian Screen Awards. Alan says that his wilderness years were a failure. Another perspective would be that they were a gestation period, a time he needed to work through to find his own voice. I spoke to him recently on what the Canadian Prime Minister dubbed the Tragically Hip Day, a day marked to honor the final concert of the band that has become a Canadian institution, but has also not quite broken outside their home country. My name is Adrian, and this is your Doc Pod. On your page, on your web page, you refer to yourself as a late bloomer.
Yeah.
And are you serious about this, or are you being glib?
No, I think that's. I mean, if that term has a meaning, it can't possibly apply to anyone more than myself. You know, it also depends what it means. Late. You know, I was trying to make films from the time I was 24. You know, onwards, but the first film that anybody saw, the reason we're talking now, was finished when I was 48. You know, what I don't know what you want to call the 24 to 48 period. It's not like I didn't exist, but I had not bloomed before 48. And then at 58, I had my first and only child. I mean, you know, the weird part of all that is that it's very hard after 25 years of failure and struggle, that becomes your identity. That becomes your self-image. And it doesn't take much. A few films later, and people are referring to you as a veteran filmmaker, acclaimed filmmaker, like, you know, he's been with us forever. Yeah, no, I haven't. I'm 64 now. I've made 7 films in those years. Like, it's almost like, oh, yeah, he was making films back in the 40s, but no, I wasn't. Like, my entire career basically happened after I was 50. So I think late bloomer is, you know, I don't know what else I would have to do to qualify for that.
What does that mean in practical terms? I mean, how has it manifested in the way that you've led your life up to this point? I mean, since the release of vinyl, let's say, does it make everything a little bit more urgent? Is there a sense of anxiety? Are there any special emotions attached to it?
I'm not sure the terms that you laid out there are, I don't think they're the ones I would use. But I would just say, I think, no, there was no sense of urgency. The only thing that really happened was I never wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. I never thought I would be a documentary filmmaker. I made a film that is a documentary, although I could qualify that in any number of ways. But I made a film that basically was a documentary film. It premiered in Toronto Documentary Film Festival. And after I made it, I thought, okay, well, now I'm, you know, I didn't think I would continue to make documentaries. I just happened to make that film. But my friend said something like, you know, maybe you should jump on this. Here is a place you've gotten acceptance for the first time. Maybe rather than going back to the rejection you experienced in fiction filmmaking, you could try. And so then it was like, okay, but like, I just made a film about record collecting because I'm a record collector. And I just thought that would be a cool subject. But what am I supposed to do now that I'm a documentary filmmaker, make a film about global warming or, you know, like African children? Like, and so the truth is that might sound glib or silly or something, but it's still an issue for me that documentary subjects do not really come to me or they come to me, but I'm not interested in them when they come. So anyway, it was just like, well, with vinyl, I felt like myself and my editor, Chris Donaldson, kind of invented a way of telling personal stories. So I just thought, I'll do it again. Let's see if I can do it again. Then when I did it again, it was like, okay, let's do it one more time, call it a trilogy, move on. Although I didn't really know what moving on would be. So there's a connection. There's definitely a connection between what I've done in the last 15 years and the fact that it started late in my life. But I don't think I think now that I'm 64 is the first time that I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do before I die? But the last 15 years, no, I didn't really think that. I thought, you know, I made the trilogy, then I thought I'm going to stop. But, you know, it turned out that the next four films I made were, I don't know, some of the same impulses came up in those films. But yeah, to me, it's like those three films and then the four films afterward are kind of like two different periods. And I'm never going to get rid of this feeling that I'm only making documentaries because, well, I mean, I'm making them because I think I'm good at them. But then in a certain way, it also feels like I'm hiding from going back to fiction, which I truly would like to do, or maybe not truly would like to do. I've never stopped wanting to, but I may never go back.
So if you had to label yourself, if you had to put a label on yourself now, what kind of a filmmaker would you say you are?
I can tell you the word that I hate. Documentarian. Like, I think you can make a meal out of the fact that that word even exists. That's how separate documentaries are seen, that there's a word, documentarian. I mean, I just say filmmaker, and if people say documentary filmmaker, that's okay with me because that's accurate, even though I made, you know, I go out of my way not to even talk about the films I made before vinyl, including there's one feature or drama I made that I don't even put on my resume. Not that I really need a resume anymore, but yeah, I like filmmaker. I don't want to get out your tiny violins, but before I made vinyl, that was 25 years where I made four films and I was doing this and I was doing that and I was driving cab and I was driving on films and I was trying to learn to write. And if somebody said, what do you do? I don't feel I earned the right to say I'm a filmmaker. I felt like that would be bragging and kind of, and also because a lot of people say they're a filmmaker when they made one film at film school, and that kind of bugs me. So I was just not, you know, I just wouldn't say it. People say, what did you do? I would say I drive cab. After I made vinyl and I had a little, whatever, success, we can call it, I felt like, yeah, I can say I'm a filmmaker, and that really means a lot to me. Like filmmaking, yeah, I love it. I love filmmaking. I love filmmakers. I feel like they're my tribe, as much as certainly equal to being Jewish, my Jewish tribe, my filmmaking tribe. I don't know. Anyway, I like saying I'm a filmmaker. I don't even like saying I'm a director. I like saying I'm a filmmaker.
Are you influenced by any other forms of media? Any other forms of storytelling?
I think when I made vinyl, I was most influenced by literature. I was most influenced by, you know, sort of vaguely autobiographical fiction, like Bukowski or, let's say Bukowski, and I can't think of the other examples right now. So
Harvey Pekar?
Yeah. Well, Harvey Pekar was a huge influence on me, and I got to meet him, and it's in two of my films. So that kind of stuff probably was more, I mean, my biggest influences in film were Cassavetes and classic 70s American cinema, Five Easy Pieces, Taxi Driver, etc. But I don't feel like I ever got to really, show those influences in my work. I don't know. I don't think I can make a case that the influence of Cassavetes is seen in any of my documentaries. So I don't think anybody who made documentaries have influenced my documentaries as much as I might have liked this film or that film. You know, after fact, I've seen Alan Berliner films that I think I feel a connection to. I suppose I was influenced, influenced by Sherman's March, you know, which used a similar technique, but not to the same end. Yeah, so Sherman's March, I've seen things afterwards that I like, but when I made vinyl, I was not influenced by, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and I ended up doing the autobiographical part more because of my interest and love for fiction, vaguely fictional literature, more about literature and confessionals and storytelling in a certain way. Maybe even, I mean, I can't say I was influenced by Spalding Gray, but stuff like Spalding Gray was much more influential to me when I started making docs than any docs.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in Toronto?
Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard thing to say. I mean, I grew up in a sheltered suburban neighborhood, and I don't know, that's a hard question to answer. Like, the funny thing about Toronto, though, for the film business is, when I first became a filmmaker, which was like 1977, there really was no film business here, but there was like just enough fumes to think that maybe you could be a filmmaker and stay in Toronto. And I think I was afraid to go somewhere else, like Los Angeles, which I should have gone. I mean, on some level, I should have gone there, but then who knows if it would have worked out. And so in a weird way, even though there's 1,000 times more film business in Toronto than there ever was in 1977, it still is sort of true that you can kind of have a career here, but it still isn't really, you know, I mean, that people forget about Toronto. People have film careers in Calgary, which is even less possible. People have them in Sarnia, Ontario. I met filmmakers like, can't really have a career in Sarnia, but you can kind of have a career in Sarnia. So that's one thing about Toronto, which is it's the center of the Canadian film business. There are now a number of successful Toronto filmmakers and have been for a number of years. A lot of them, including David Cronenberg, never left. You know, TIFF is here, but still, it's not Los Angeles. It's not, you know, that's all you can say again and again and again. It's Los Angeles is where the business is. And so, I mean, the thing about Toronto is, if you came from Timmins, Ontario or something, you have to leave. You know, you have to go to the big city. But if you're already kind of in the big city, you don't have to. There never was a compelling reason for me to leave Toronto, even though, you know, the people that really make it kind of have to leave. So,
And when you were a kid growing up, then were you dreaming of leaving or were you?
No, I never dreamed of leaving. I mean, I dreamed of being a rock star. I dreamed of getting laid. I didn't dream of being famous. I don't know what I dreamed of, to be honest. I don't remember dreaming of anything except probably, yes, I wanted to be a rock star, even though I didn't, you know, take any music lessons. So that wasn't going to work out. And I think I always had a vague drive to express myself, but that drive was not encouraged. So I didn't really think that was going to happen. It's just sort of like, I was headed to law school and I kept thinking, oh, I don't want to be a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer. Although if I'd known how little money I'd make, I'd probably, you know.
Was this your parents that were sort of pushing you towards law?
You know, my parents didn't push me as much as other people did. And if they had, maybe I would have. No, it was just, you know, you're upper middle class Jewish. You don't have a father's business to go into. You know, if you're getting good marks in science, you become a doctor. And if you're getting okay marks in non-science, you go into law or accounting. And in fact, I didn't really realize how much it was in the mother's milk being Jewish. And one time my friend who ended up going to medical school, we ran into his grandfather, who was actually kind of a famous Jewish. He owned a creamery in Toronto that was sort of infamous. But anyway, he said to us the classic thing, there's only three things a Jew can be, a doctor or a dentist, a lawyer or an accountant, or own your own business. That's it. You have to pick a job where they can never fire you because you're a Jew. They're going to fire you. They're going to try and get rid of you. You have to be in one of those independent positions. And I was not aware that that influenced me, but I think it must have, because I really didn't think about any other possibilities except not being a lawyer. It's sort of like, what am I going to be? Not a lawyer, you know, although I would have been a good lawyer. Like, I'm very argumentative, aggressive. I probably would have been good at it.
I have a feeling. I was just going to say that, actually. So overall, your childhood, your youth, were they, do you have like a fond feeling for them? Was that a happy time?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to come up with traumatizing stories from my youth. I'll only say that when I got to high school, well, you know, at that time when I was in high school, the popular kid, it was no longer the captain of the football team. It was the long-haired guy who smoked dope and had cool records. So I was, you know, I would say I was an affiliate member of the cool team. But I don't know how to say this. It's like my whole life I felt like I didn't have the friends that I deserved. Now, that's not completely true. In my 30s and early 40s, I felt like I sort of did. But for that period, I always felt like that. So in high school, I think I was just lonely. It wasn't a horrible period for me. My home life was always good. My parents were, you know, my father was a special guy, and my mother was a good mother. And I had three siblings who I loved and I still love. And I'm going to see them all on Monday at my house for dinner and all that. But I always felt like I should be recognized more than I was, and sort of, it's like I never, you know, it's like they were always having a party that I wasn't invited to, even though if they thought of me, they might go, oh, yeah, he could be here. But I don't know. They thought I was at another cool party and thought, yeah, why would he want to? I don't know what it was, but I've always had that feeling. And even though that doesn't seem like a big deal, that was a little sad. And it was a sadness that I've never quite escaped. I felt that same feeling almost my whole life.
It sounds like you felt like an outsider, even though maybe you weren't.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was brought up to be an outsider. My father told, I mean, I wish he was alive to deny this or whatever, but I felt like my father literally sat me down and said, we're Jews, they hate us, we'll always be outsiders, but we can minimize that and deal with it and still have a good life. So I always thought I was going to be an outsider, but I'm talking about a high school with all Jews. So that wasn't the issue. And I don't know that everybody else didn't feel that way. Although, you know what? I'm going to ask a couple of them finally in the next little while. But yeah, there have been times in my life where I had a gang of friends and we got together and it was easy to phone them and say, hey, what are you doing? You know, hey, let's get together. Hey, meet you there. Like, but I don't have that now. And I didn't have it in high school. And I didn't have it for, yeah, it's always this kind of like weird yearning for some Algonquin round table or Cheers bar or something that I can go to and be one of the gang.
Right, but when you say the friends that you deserved, you mean just people that you can call up anytime, or do you mean specific type of people?
Wow, to say specific type of people sounds wrong.
No, what I mean is people that are into music, or people that are artists, or intellectuals, or whatever.
Well, people that get my humor and I get theirs, and people that don't make me talk too much because they're throwing their stuff in too, and you know, like I have a friend who shall remain nameless. He's a filmmaker in Canada. He's more successful than me. Every time we see each other at a party, we end up talking for like 3 hours. But that guy is famously kind of reclusive. He and I are friends. We would make great, you know, hanging buddies, but I'm not one of his hanging buddies. And he does have some hanging buddies, and I'm not one of them. You know, he would say, well, call me more or something. But anyway, anyway, I don't think it's completely true. And I don't, you know, if I say that I don't have the friends that I deserve, then what are my friends that I do have going to say? Like, I do have some friends that I deserve now, and I have, but also it's just a matter of age. Like, you know, whatever. I can't imagine this is interesting in a film discussion, but when you're 60 and you have a friend who's 30, well, you and your friend are ageless to each other, maybe, to some degree. But then if you go and hang out with him and his friends will have a girlfriend who's 20. And then she's going to look at you and be like, who brought their dad? You know, so it just, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm in a business that's with young people, and I basically do get accepted, I feel. I don't think they look at me like, you know, if I was with them and we were at a movie and I took the senior rate, I think they'd be kind of surprised. But, you know, my best friend died. Like, I mean, people my age die. So, in fact, I'm thinking of making a film about that. I mentioned this to somebody and they said, oh, yeah, the problem of friendship in older men. And I was like, oh, it's a thing? It's an issue? Okay. Anyway, yes, that's to answer your question. That thing I'm experiencing now, in a weird way, I experienced it in high school. And I went to my 40th high school reunion a few years ago. And all the sort of weird disconnection that had been somehow just under the surface at high school was very evident that day. I could not relate to them. They could not relate to me. They had no idea who I was. I mean, that year I won, well, the Genie, the Canadian, like the version of the Canadian Oscar for Best Documentary. None of them had a clue. They just didn't know who I was. They just noticed that I'd gained a lot of weight and my hair was too long. And that I felt like I never felt more like an outsider than at my 40th high school reunion.
Interesting. Now, I'm going to use this word, and it now sounds a little bit funny because you got it in the title of one of your films, but I'm going to use it anyway, so the curmudgeon element. And I'm curious whether you were curmudgeon-y as a child, or is that something that developed later? I'll tell you my theory, actually.
Go ahead.
Well, my theory is that curmudgeon-y behavior is a social mask. It's like a strategy that's not too different from, you know, the jock or the long-haired guy that smokes pot. You know, the intention is the same behind all of these identities when you're young, which is like survival and prosperity. You know, and a jock wants to show how strong he is physically, you know, so he lifts weights and he's macho. But the curmudgeon, he wants to show everybody how smart he is. You know, so he's constantly pointing out all of these things that people normally don't pay attention to. And there is a certain amount of cool and a kind of a macho element to cynicism. You know, and you have people like Dylan or Morrison or Nick Cave today, you know, who are turning cynicism into like a virtue.
Okay, well, so here's my answer. First of all, I just think my negativity originated in, you know, whether I was directly taught at my father's knee, nothing was funnier than a witheringly critical remark, as long as it was accurate. You know, there was no humor. I mean, that's what Jews Were Funny was about. There's no such thing as humor without negativity. There's no happy humor. So, I mean, I just think making a funny remark, making a critical remark, that was very clearly told to me that was what was funny. That's what would make my father laugh. And everybody in my family has that a bit. Everybody knows that. It would be hard for me to say something negative in front of my siblings for them to go, that was too much. Although, yes, I could, but I wouldn't go there. That's number one. Number two, you know, somebody in I Curmudgeon says, I'm not negative. I'm just a disappointed idealist. So I definitely think, yes, I was brought up in the 60s and the civil rights movement. I believed whatever we were going to, the world was going to change. And then you spend the rest of your life amazed that all those people that made the world that you wanted to change, they didn't never went away, and they just rearing their ugly head again and again and again, and now they're, you know, they're one of those might be president of the United States. So that, and then the other thing is, I think this is a big part of everything that happened in my life, even though it seems kind of crazy theory, but when I was in grade one, the teachers told my parents that me and my friend had no point in us being in grade two. So they skipped us. That's what, which they don't do anymore, but in those days they did. So you skip. So we skipped from one to three. Now we were with kids who were a year older than us at a time that seven and six was a giant gap. Number two, somehow, and it might have something to do with my parents' reaction, I sort of feel like when they told my parents that I was smart, after that, being smart was not really, you know, impressive to them anymore. It's like, ooh, he's smart. Well, they told us that. So what happened, I feel like, is that being smart didn't mean anything to me anymore. And here I was with these older kids trying to overcompensate. Overcompensating for our age difference, trying to be noticed, not wanting to be noticed for being smart. So the only thing left was to be noticed for being bad or being funny. And I already had that going for me. So I just became, you know, the class clown and ended up getting into trouble. By grade four, I got the strap, you know, corporal punishment, and was more proud of my outlaw, rebel, whatever, than my intelligence. And that probably has never gone away.
I'm going to take it further. And I'm going to say that there's a moment in your life or in a person's life, let's say when they're young, that being negative, and it's not just being negative for the sake of being negative, it's like questioning the status quo by pointing out hypocrisies in the world, you know, the holes in the logic of our cultures. That kind of a thing is actually quite sexy, quite alluring. You know, it's kind of mysterious and interesting. And I think it gives people some cachet. But I think that after a certain age, and it almost drops on a dime, I think that the exact same quality becomes like a total drag and people hate having it around them. You know, so the same thing that makes you quite successful socially as a young person makes you into a kind of a pariah as an adult. What do you think?
Okay, well, so here's one thing I can say. I'm not sure that's connected. One thing I found was, and I wish somebody had told me this earlier, although I probably wouldn't have paid attention. If you're successful, you can be whatever you want. You can be as big a prick as you want to be. But if you're the exact same prick and not successful, you are a pariah for sure. And then the other thing is, what are you being negative about? Are you being negative about your life, or are you being negative about fracking or something? Like, I think that makes a difference.
That's what I'm talking about, because the people I think that you profile in your film are all talking about things in the social fabric that are not quite good.
So are you saying that the people in my film are bordering on being pariahs because they're a little bit too old to still be talking about those things?
Something like that. I think that the tolerance level that the average person has for hearing about that kind of stuff, but when that stuff is accurate, is what I mean. It's almost like a reminder of the fact that the status quo is not quite working. I think your friend actually sums it up really nicely. His name is Mike Cartmel. He talks about the jet skis, and he says that curmudgeonry is kind of like akin to mutiny. And then that element is quite attractive to younger people because they're rebellious. But after a certain age, people want to settle down, and that same quality becomes quite threatening because it will upset the status quo and people depend on the status quo.
Well, okay. So first of all, I have to say I'm very touched that you're quoting Mike, because Mike is my friend who died 2 years ago, and I miss him and I love the idea of his name even being spoken. Yeah, well, I never really thought about this. This is funny. Yes, I guess it's definitely more socially acceptable to be an iconoclast when you're 18 than when you're 38. Although, yeah, I don't know. That's probably true. And that's probably something that most of the people in my film didn't appreciate and didn't even know. Yeah, that's interesting. Why should I change? This is how I've always been. The world hasn't.
I agree. Let's change subject. I'm wondering where the music passion started, the listening to music. Where did that come from?
It came from, I don't know. I was 12 years old. It was the day after my 12th birthday, the first time Beatles played on Ed Sullivan. Up to that moment, I wasn't really paying attention to music. But yeah, then that whole thing and the rock and roll, British Invasion and American and the Byrds and Dylan and all that, that was the most important thing in the world to me. This is the first thing I discovered that was my culture, not my parents. And I think everything that happened to me in my life is a result of that. I don't even know what to call it. I didn't really buy records yet. I was just very focused on, rock and roll. In my entire teenage years, I was very desperate to experience it, even though I was kind of too scared for a long time to venture out and see any bands and clubs. Whatever I could somehow bring into my own living room, I did. I would scour the TV for any appearance of any musicians. I had a tape recorder with a microphone. I turn on the show. I push the microphone up to the speaker, and then I would make recordings of, whatever was on TV. I don't know. I've never really tried to analyze what was going on there, except I guess on some level, having been told that I was part of an outsider class, I was attracted to whatever, cool outsiders, and wanted to be one of them, wanted to be cool. I'd like to think that it's not as important to me as it was 50 years ago, but no, it's still important. I mean, it's important to me to not do anything to be cool, which isn't to say I don't have the impulse to do things to be cool. There's a number of things that I've wanted to do in my films because I think it would be cool. And almost every time I try one of these things, I'm like, fuck. Why does this work in everybody else's film, but it doesn't work in my film? And then I don't even know if it doesn't work. Maybe I'm just so aware that I'm doing it for that purpose that, I'm just too aware why I'm doing it. And that's what makes it not work for me. Here's a good example about everybody. I think people who watch films today, the term B-roll. My entire career as a documentary filmmaker has been a battle with the very notion of B-roll. B-roll has been this, you could sort of do almost a book about the evolution of B-roll in the last 15 years. And B-rolls have become sort of cooler and cooler. And then people started doing this thing, not just in documentaries, where a guy's talking, and then they cut to a shot of the guy not talking, just staring into the camera. And they're using that shot as B-roll for the guy talking. And I thought that was really cool. But first couple of times I tried to do it, I thought, this is stupid. Why is the guy just staring into the camera? Like, what the fuck is going on here? And even like, this seems counterproductive. Like, he's staring into the camera. He's staring right at you. This is not producing the feeling that you want with your B-roll. So I couldn't do it. Although I did a little bit of it in A Hard Name, but not much. So, yeah.
Now, we were talking about music and how that was important to you when you were younger. I'm wondering what kind of relationship you had with films when you were that age.
I think that when I was a kid, I wasn't thinking that I would ever make films. I had no impulse whatsoever towards making films. And so movies were, just like they are for everybody else, like ones I like, ones I don't like. I never saw a movie before I started thinking about making movies that made me go, I want to make movies. Probably my taste had a lot to do with my father. I liked movies where a lot of people got killed. I liked sort of mysteries. I liked James Bond. And I do remember occasionally seeing something, in those days, stuff showed up on TV that was completely unlikely. You'd come home at 4 o'clock for the after school movie, and instead of being, you know, Audie Murphy Western, it would be The Swimmer with Burt Lancaster, or Seconds with Rock Hudson, or The Naked Jungle, or the one with Cornel Wilde running naked the whole time. I think
The Naked Prey,
or, you know, whatever. But I mean, or I don't know how this is possible, since I know that the film was removed from circulation, but my father made me watch Manchurian Candidate on TV once. And it was like, yeah. So I had those moments where I'm like, ooh, this is different. And I think that's what happened the first time. I think I did see Cassavetes before I was thinking about making films. And I had no awareness of documentaries at all when I was a kid.
So when did the interest develop? I mean, what sparked it off? Films or documentaries?
Well, documentaries, that never happened. Like, what happened was, I made a feature film in 1994 that was just a big mistake. It was just like a big, stupid mistake that I made because I didn't believe in myself. And I was very disappointed, whatever. It was kind of a weird self-loathing decision to make.
This is the one called Stealing Images, is that right?
No, it's called The Darwin Family.
Okay.
And I was pretty well thinking, I'm getting out of the film business. Like, that's it. I had my shot. I applied for an Arts Council grant to make a fiction film in which record collecting was, you know, a central plot point. In the application to get the grant, I talked about my personal relationship to collecting records as a kind of way for them to understand the territory in which the film took place. I got the grant, and almost right away I thought, well, if I have to write a script to make this film, that's going to take a year or so of rewriting, at the end of which most of the money will be gone. And then it'll be another script in the drawer with other six or seven scripts that I was paid to make, but that I never got production money for. And in the meantime, I saw this film that a friend of mine shot where he was using a Hi-8 video camera. And it was the first video I ever saw that didn't make me nauseous. Like, it was like, oh, you know what? That's kind of cool. Like, it almost looks like Super 8. And then the people on the jury told me, you got the money because of that personal story you told about record collecting, not really because of the plot of the fiction film you were going to make. And it's just like, it all came together, and I thought, okay, I'm going to make a film about my personal story, and I'm going to buy one of these cameras. So I bought the cameras for like $800. I took it home. I started to figure out how to talk. I was like, well, how is my story going to get in the film if I just interview a bunch of people? Maybe they won't tell my story. Well, maybe you should talk into the camera. And then I tried some of the conventional ways, you know, like pointing a camera at me and looking in a monitor to see what the shot was like, et cetera, et cetera. And that was very intimidating to see myself in this monitor. Made it impossible for me to talk with this camera, you know, with this camera pointed at me. So then I started, you know, I figured out whatever. That mirror thing came to me of doing it. And there I was, like, a week later, rather than working on a script for a film that would never be made, I was shooting footage for a film that was already being made. That was thrilling. But I was still afraid to go out and interview people because I never interviewed anybody. But I made, you know, I shot in my apartment for like a month, and I was like, whoop, you know, yippee, this is fun. I'm making a movie. The fact that it was a documentary was all completely irrelevant to me until the film was rejected from Toronto Film Festival and got accepted in Hot Docs and was a big success in a documentary festival. And then people are like, oh, you're a documentary filmmaker? And I was like, okay, I guess so. Yeah. So if any one of those things had not occurred, I'm not sure I would have made a documentary. I certainly wouldn't have made a documentary if I had to shoot it on film. I wouldn't have made that film if I had to shoot it on film. I wouldn't have let myself talk and talk and talk and talk and talk into the camera if I had to, you know, load another mag of 400-foot roll that lasts 10 minutes. And I wouldn't have shot it in video because, you know, 20 years ago, video was for a very specific purpose and had nothing. Even documentaries were not shot on video. You couldn't get your movie into a film festival, even a documentary festival, if it was shot on tape. You couldn't, You know, even when Vinyl was finished in 2000, I couldn't put it into the competition for Best Documentary in Canada because it wasn't on film. Like, when I started shooting it, films weren't made on video. And, you know, the year before I started shooting it, I cut my film on film. Like, you're cutting on film, you shot on film, film was it. And I was a filmmaker and I hated video, like every other filmmaker. It's only because I saw this Hi-8 footage that I was like, oh, I don't hate video as much. So that's the one thing, like, definitely, if I'd not bought a Hi-8 camera there, I wouldn't be talking to you now. Like, that film would not have been made. And then I wonder if it would have been made if the juror had not said to me that your little personal essay was what sold the film. Because, you know, that whole telling personal story thing was not really part of my self-image until, you know, and I tell you, if somebody had told me, said at that point to me, you're a storyteller, I would have said, fuck off. Like, I hated that idea, etc. But, you know, when that person said that to me, and here I was sitting with $30,000, and I didn't want to waste it, because I'd wasted a lot of money writing scripts that didn't get made into films. Yeah. So I feel like it was like the perfect things happened to lead me in that direction.
What do you think it was about the telling of the personal story that you were able to make a success out of, that telling a narrative story like you did in The Darling Family didn't work?
Well, fiction films cost more money. So even if that's a non-issue, it's sort of like the way you have to ask to make a fiction film is different from the way you have to ask to make a documentary, though that has changed. But that was true in those days. So in the 20 years that I tried to make fiction films, I feel like I compromised my vision, for lack of a better word, little by little by little by little by little, till I got to the point that I'm not even sure I could remember anymore what I really wanted to do. I wasn't being authentically myself anymore when I was trying to get fiction films made. And that is an issue that I still have today. Whereas with documentary, well, not documentary, but with that film, I had absolutely nothing to lose because I'd already failed. And I already basically believed that my career was over and I was just trying to use up this money. And maybe it would be a film or maybe it wouldn't be a film. But nobody had ever seen anything I'd made before, so they weren't going to see this one. And so, like, the truth is that even while we were editing the film, I was saying to myself and to my editor, am I really going to tell a story about my dog dying in a film about record collecting? Like, what the fuck? Why am I doing this? But I wanted to do it. Like, can you really do this? Are you allowed to do this? Are you allowed to talk about everything but record collecting in a film about record collecting? I don't know, but I like it. So I'm going to do it because I got nothing to lose because nobody's going to see it because they never have before. So I think that's the answer.
Yeah, I think that there's something about being authentic that trumps everything else. And that thing about pursuing the thing that is true to you, it's a bit of a cliche, but I think there's so much truth to it because it's like when you're being authentic, even if you make mistakes, it doesn't matter because they're authentic and the mistakes themselves have meaning and they're a valuable part of the process.
You know, I think that there's two things. It's like being yourself is something that's sort of bred out of you or society kicks it out of you. And so a lot of people would have a hard time being their authentic selves. Why it wasn't kicked out of me yet, I don't know. That just some of it wasn't, and that's the whole sort of negativity pariah thing. I was still, something kept my authentic self still somewhere lingering in the background for me to call on it. But then the second thing is, you know, and people have said this about my films, and I know what they mean. If you're flipping through the dial and you go past something that in ways you could never articulate, just kind of looked like, what the fuck was that doing on my TV? And you go back. And then you're like, there's just something different about it. You know, it's a movie. it's in a frame, it cuts, it whatever, but it's just like, oh, like, what's going on here? Like, I mean, there's something about this movie that I've never seen them do that. It could even be, you know, like, somebody could make all the mistakes in the world. That would be kind of amazing. That's why, and whatever. I'm not a Harmony Korine fan, but I think that's why Harmony Korine was successful, and that's why John Waters was successful. And so I don't think being yourself works for everybody, but it worked for me.
Where did you study, by the way?
I went to a film school called Sheridan, which has become famous for its animation school, but not for its film school.
Was it film specifically that you studied, or did you do a degree in something else and then switch to film somehow?
What happened was, after high school, I went to university, and I was in the stream to go to law school, though I was still looking for a reason not to go to law school. In second year, I met a guy who was part of a gang of people from high school who once a year together, collectively, the 30 of them would make a movie. My friend roped me in. I was the one outsider. I enjoyed the experience. I didn't direct the film. I didn't edit the film. I didn't write the film. I just worked on the film. Me and my friend edited it for like 6 months in the basement of York University, where I was going to get my bachelor degree in sociology, which is basically pre-law. I kind of thought, oh, that would be fun, but I didn't really think about it. I graduated university. I applied to law school. I got in, and I was like, oh, I can't bring myself to do it. So I decided to travel. I traveled. I ended up in India, somewhere on the road to India. I thought, no, I can't be a lawyer. I came home. I couldn't figure out what to do with my life. I wasn't ready to start. I went to India again. I came home from there. It was like, now you have to start life. And it's like my parents were crestfallen that I wasn't going to law school. So I said, well, what about film school? You know, it's got the word school. And so I applied to York University. I went to talk to the dean or the person of admissions at York University. I told him sort of what I was looking for. This guy, whose name was Ken Danziger, said to me, I just came here to York, but I used to teach at this place, Sheridan in Oakville. I think you'll like it better there. I think it'll fit you better. I don't know why he said that. But I ended up going to Sheridan in Oakville. And Sheridan in Oakville was not a film school in any conventional sense. There was no teaching about fiction film. There was no teaching about documentary. There was just sort of two basically experimental filmmakers who just showed you movies and told you to express yourself and told you anything that you do goes. I didn't know what a dolly was. I didn't know what anything was. It was just like, here's a camera. There's the editing machine. Here's some movies that might influence you, which were mostly American underground movies from the 70s, from when they went to university. That's film school. And so again, that also probably had a lot to do with what happened to me, is that these guys didn't teach me any rules. They just taught me, you know, do what you think is right. And the film I made in second year, The Boys, was, you know, in the terms of Sheridan and film school, a success, a hit. It was my adolescent take on Husbands, the Cassavetes film. It was also a mockumentary, though the term didn't exist. There's four guys hang out all night trying to figure out what to do, but the four guys were not friends. I cast them. So it was an improvised drama masquerading as a documentary.
Interesting. So you say this was considered a success?
Well, a film school success. But the point is, I launched myself out of film school thinking, oh, I'm going to be successful because look at what happened with The Boys.
Did this transition you from college into professional life then?
No, it just, whatever, it made me think that I had talent or something like that, or I had what it takes, because there was no indication before that, that this is something I should be doing.
What you're saying is that you were praised for doing this thing, and suddenly you thought, this is something I'm going to do.
Yeah.
But then it wasn't so easy.
And I thought that it would just transition into success in the outside world. But that was stupid.
You know, I was watching, a few months ago, I was watching Videodrome, and I was sitting through the credits, and then your name popped up. How did you get that gig?
I was driving cab. My friend David Chud, who went to film school with me, had started working on Canadian film productions as a driver. And he said, you know, you like driving, you're a cab driver, you want to get into film. So I went. And that was the first film I drove on.
So were you involved in the production in any way aside from the driving? Did you get a chance to watch the film being made?
Well, drivers are not encouraged to be on set. I did see some stuff. I saw some sets. I saw James Woods, but no, I was in no way involved in the production. Drivers, if you choose to be a driver, it's something that, like, at that point, if I had chosen to be a PA, I could have worked my way up. You can work your way up from a PA to be a first AD, and I've even known some first ADs who became successful directors. But I did not want to be in that stream. I wanted to be an outsider, funny, even to the film crew, because I was going to do my own thing. So I live to regret that decision later because, you know, I had one friend in particular who got into continuity. Continuity is an amazing position to be in. You see the whole film being made. You're right there next to the camera and the director. I would have loved to experience that, but I never experienced it. I wasn't on the crew of that many good movies, but still, I would have loved to see the filmmaking process from up close, like where the grip, you know, the dolly grip gets to see everything. So I learned nothing about the filmmaking process from my 6 or 7 years driving on everything from Videodrome to The Believers, John Schlesinger, and many crappy things in between. But I learned nothing. I was a driver.
Were you working on films at all during this time? Were you making something of your own?
I made 2 short films of my own in that period.
How did that go?
Not very well. Well, one of them, this film, Where's Howie, was the first film I made after The Boys. It was made in the same style as The Boys, but it just didn't work for lots of reasons that, you know, I could go into, but some of it just because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. I really, 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 really didn't know what I was doing. The last film I made in that period, Stealing Images, actually was another moment like The Boys. It was like, that really worked out. I won the best short film at Toronto Film Festival. I was proud of that film. But at that point, I had stopped driving. So again, I thought, okay, here I go, but didn't work out that way.
It's interesting. So what kept you interested? What kept you going through all of those years of being rejected? I mean, didn't you think at some point, okay, this isn't working out, let's just move on to the next thing. Let's become a lawyer.
Yeah. So people think that was my stick-to-itiveness, but I think it was my laziness. I just couldn't think of anything else to do. I preferred to fail at this thing than find something else. I think I did think about law school again in the 90s, and then I thought, no, I don't want to be a lawyer, or it's too late, or, you know, I couldn't think of anything else. It's not that I thought I was going to succeed, it's that I just couldn't think of anything else.
I have this sort of thought that people that drift, or people that procrastinate, or people who are interested in many different things but don't seem to be able to commit to any of them, I have this feeling that those people, they are kind of sitting around collecting experiences, collecting skills, and maybe looking for a niche for themselves. And maybe it's not like a conscious thing. Maybe they are doing it subconsciously. But, I mean, did you ever get a feeling that you are building up to something that maybe you don't quite fit into the industry the way that it was at that point, but that one day you will kind of stumble into something that you will be perfect for? And maybe these personality traits of yours, maybe the angst or the bitterness and the different skills that you gained during this period, that you would find the perfect thing for that cocktail.
That's a good way to tell the story, but no, I didn't think that. I didn't think that, but I'll tell you a story, my favorite story of my own career. After Vinyl was shown, there was a guy in Winnipeg named Dave Barber who saw it. He programs the Winnipeg Cinematheque. He did then. He does to this day. He was a major supporter of mine and an amazing guy that any city would be lucky to have him programming. In 2010 or something like that, he booked a retrospective of mine at Winnipeg, which was really, I'd made 4 documentaries. So I went there and showed those 4 documentaries. I introduced my films in the sort of way I used to, which was, these films are all a result of the failure, the previous 25 years of failure that led to me making mine. So I'm in the hallway and there's two guys there, young guys, and I can see they're like talking very enthusiastically to each other, but they're kind of looking over, and I'm really getting the feeling that the guy's building up the courage to come over to me. He builds up the courage. He comes over to me and he says, if you had succeeded at any point in those previous 25 years, would you have made vinyl? And I was like, certainly not. And he said, I knew it. And then he went back to his friend and they were both really excited by that answer. And I realized, yeah, exactly. Had I succeeded at making fiction films, I might have become, if I'm lucky, I'd be directing Game of Thrones and stuff like that. But I'd probably just be doing Canadian TV show that you've never heard of. And I would have been much richer, and I never would have made anything that was in any way distinct or personal or anything.
Yeah, because I mean, I think what they were trying to say was that the 25 years that you talk about of failure that you say, that would have been like a preliminary, like a necessity. Vinyl was the result.
Yeah, that's all true. I mean, that's why it's sort of like after that, it was sort of hard to talk, to preface everything with the failure. Like, it's part of the story, but I don't have to introduce every film as like, here's a film I wouldn't have made if I hadn't failed, even though that's how I feel. But no, I mean, I've had little moments like that. Like one time a guy phoned me up and said, I live in London, Ontario. I saw your film in Vancouver. I'm back home in London. None of my friends have seen your film because they are in London, Ontario. Can we have a screening in London, Ontario? It was like, oh my God, that's the nicest thing anybody ever said to me. I mean, I talk about whatever success, but what it's about is having an audience. When I was a failure, I made films. I had no audience. They didn't see it. And I had no idea what having an audience would feel like. But when you have an audience, you're part of a conversation. You're in contact with the world. That's what you want. Like, I love connecting with people that I've never met and never will meet.
How do you find your subjects? How do you get people to appear in your film?
Most people say yes. The first time I had a lot of people say no was in Lovable. People would say, yes, I'm single. Yes, I totally relate to the material. No, I'm not going to be some loser in your film talking about being single. Yeah, that was the first film where I had a problem. Then the next film I made, Our Name, I was trying to make a film exclusively about people who had been in jail a long time and were now like in their 70s. And I couldn't find a single person, so I had to make it just vaguely middle-aged people who had been in prison.
So many of the people that feature in your films, they are very often people that have struggled one way or another in life and people who have had some trauma, particularly in their childhoods. And now you're talking about A Hard Name, and I think the Steve Fonio film is the same. But I actually saw a lot of similar traits in some of the vinyl participants, in some of the Lovable women, and especially in I, Curmudgeon. And I'm wondering what it is that draws you, that keeps drawing you back to these people and people who are struggling.
I think that essentially what happened was I had a sheltered upbringing. I was brought up by people who had succeeded where their grandparents hadn't, where their parents hadn't. I had no idea that the world would not cooperate with anything I wanted to do. And when I found out that the world wouldn't cooperate, it was like I felt like the truth, you know, the truth of the world was shown to me, not a truth that I wanted shown to me or that I wanted to experience, but it was shown to me. It was like, you know, I don't know if anybody lives a charmed life, but the world is not your oyster. And even wanting very small things can be a struggle. Not that the world's a horrible place or anything like that. Just, you know, when I came to make a film about Steve Fonio, a man who had struggled far more and continue to struggle far more than I ever struggled, I nonetheless related to his struggle, even though mine was modest compared to his and modest compared to many other people that I've talked to. But I relate to that. I relate to, I don't know, it sounds so glib or banal, like life is hard, but I didn't know life was hard. And then I did. And I had moments of deeper despair than I ever thought I would experience. Just like, you know, oh my God, I can't believe this is not working out. I'm 45. I have no career. I have no family. I have no children. I have no connections. I have nothing. I'm just like, you know?
It's interesting. It's interesting that that could be as devastating as, say, losing your leg or ending up in prison.
I can't compare it. I mean, you know, a few years ago, there was a tremendous push in the culture to talk about happiness, you know, happiness coaches. And I even had some interest from people, for me, of all people, who made I Curmudgeon, to make a film about happiness. So I sort of became aware of all the talk around happiness. And there was this film called War Photographer.
Yeah, it's about James Nachtway, is it?
Right. And so in that film, he goes and visits, he becomes obsessed with this family in India, I believe, who live on the train tracks in boxes. Like, they live on a broken down carton on the train tracks of India. And I'm pretty sure he overtly says that those people are as happy, are much happier than a whole bunch of people he knows in, you know, North America or Britain, who are, you know, very comfortable. So, yes, I'm aware that, like, you can be happy in living on the train tracks of India, I guess. But I was not happy living in relative comfort in Toronto because, I don't know, because I was not doing anything I wanted to do. And, but anyway, that's not even that important. All that is to say is that, you know, I say this thing in I Curmudgeon, I say this overtly in the film, in one of my mirror things. And I feel like this sort of separates my people from not my people. You know, the day I heard the expression, the only sure thing in life is pain, disappointment, etc., whatever they said. When I heard that, I was like, oh my God. Thank you. Thank you. I thought I was crazy, but okay, that's good. Like, there will be some bright spots. There will be lots of nice days, but the only sure thing is that there'll be pain and loss. I think that was like a big moment in my life when I heard somebody, when I read that. And so I guess in a way that's ended up being a big part of my interests in films. And then, you know, you have to, here's the other thing you have to say, which is that, you know, I'm not going to make 20 films, but if you're lucky, you make maybe 20 films in your life. 20 films is a lot, but it's still not a lot of subjects compared to all the subjects you could make films about in the world. And to some degree, you might be interested in 1,000 ideas that are about happiness and joy, but you might just not end up making those films, either because the funding agency says no, or you end up making the sad one, and then by the time you finish that one, you forgot about the happy one, and so you make another sad one because you come up with a sad idea.
Just going back to the people that you have filmed over the years, people who have struggles, there are also a lot of people that have sort of addiction and compulsive behavior kind of issues in those films. And, you know, you speak a lot about your own issues, about the obsessive collecting of records. There's a lot of smoking in your films. You talk about your weight issues and so on. And I'm thinking, do you think that the qualities that made you sort of accumulate all those records, or that made you like food a little bit too much, do you think that they could be driven by the same impulse that drives you today, say, to interview dozens of people for one film, or to shoot, I don't know, 100 hours of footage to make a 90-minute movie?
I can't, you know, I can't completely dismiss that notion, because I believe that you make the films that you make because you're you, and everything you do in your life is not just a series of coincidences. They're all come from a certain source, you know. I always kind of say that heroin is just a bullet I somehow dodged. I certainly had some of the characteristics of a drug-addicted person, or some of the issues, but I guess I didn't. I mean, in a weird way, if you believe people like Gabor Mate, who's an expert on the subject of addiction and who actually makes an appearance in my film Hurt, he says all addiction comes from childhood trauma, and so maybe I didn't have the right kind of childhood trauma to be addicted to heroin and crystal meth, only cigarettes and food and records. I'm not sure that my addiction to records, though it's parallel to an addiction to heroin, I'm not sure it's exactly, but I think it's the same in this one way. I feel like record collecting was a way of not thinking about anything else except records. You wake up and you're like, I should do something. Oh, wait a second. I better get to the Goodwill store, because if I don't get there now, that record that I want will be taken. It's just an obsession that will mask all your other issues. I've had that my whole life. I don't think it's accurate to say I was addicted to food. I think it's accurate to say that I was very strenuously avoiding myself. And I am now 4 weeks into what some people call a diet, but I hope it's not a diet. I hope it's a lifestyle change. And it came from somebody said to me, it's hard to love somebody that doesn't love themselves. I was like, I love myself. I love myself. I think I'm a great filmmaker, blah, 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 blah. I'm a great guy. I'm funny. But then I thought about it some more and I realized, oh my God, liking yourself and loving yourself are different. Loving yourself involves doing hard work. I don't do anything. And so I started to do something that's hard to give to myself. So I think that's sort of an answer to a lot of the stuff you just said.
Looking at the last few films, 15 Reasons to Live and Hurt in particular, it looks like you're moving more and more towards films with clear narratives, with stories rather than themes as structure. Are you interested in moving away from documentaries and attempting narrative filmmaking again?
Well, 15 Reasons to Live is just a sort of thing unto itself. It's like there was 4 years between making A Hard Name and finishing 15 Reasons to Live. And then, yeah, there was like a weird four-year walking in the desert. I don't know. After Hard Name, I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to do the same thing. I didn't want to, I can't really afford to, and now I recognize very much that I can't afford to just have this sort of indulgent artist point of view of, let me find a direction for my next opus. You know, I have to churn them out. I really do. If I don't churn them out, meaning at least a film every 2 years, you know, baby needs a new pair of shoes. I can't indulge that anymore. And it was kind of a weird and horrible period. And my wife refers to like a year that I was just in my robe, my Brian Wilson year or something. But it's true. I just didn't know what to do. I just couldn't bring myself to come up with another idea that was in my wheelhouse. I was sort of looking outside my wheelhouse. And sure, it had something to do with wanting to do fiction. I was writing. One of those years I spent writing a fiction film with my friend for him to direct. So yeah, it was partly thinking about fiction, but it was just partly this thing I think I'm always going to feel, which is the films that I made, I found a way to really play to my strong suit. And, you know, that's really hard to turn your back on. But some side of me is not satisfied doing that. So when I ran into the idea that became 15 Reasons to Live, the only idea I had at that point is I had a few friends whose story I thought was intriguing in a kind of short story classic way. And I thought, I'm going to make a film about the three friends. And why are they together in a film? I don't know. It just, that's the only thing that's interesting me now. And I can imagine a film like that being made. I can imagine liking a film like that. So then I ran into this guy who wrote a book called 15 Reasons to Live. And there was another thing going on in my head, which was the way you make these collective stories is by intercutting these people. So you meet 5 people or whatever, 10 people, and you have person 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 through 10 say something that's 1 minute long, and then you come back to them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and they say something that's 2 minutes long, and then you come back to them. You keep coming back to these stories, and you weave them, and you pepper them throughout the film. That's the standard way, And that's the way I was allowed to make a number of films that I made. And all the time that I, every time I did that, my editor and I would always say, what would it be like if we met person one, we told their whole story, we moved on to person two, never came back to person one. And we always said, well, that wouldn't work. That would be death. That would be, you know, interesting experiment that wouldn't work. And so when this person said 15 Reasons to Live, I thought 15 short stories, they can't be interwoven. And it's like, okay, the challenge of making 15 short stories that wouldn't be interwoven was enough to sort of shake me out of my doldrums, because I guess on some level, the thing that inspired me before that was simply having the feeling that this is an impossible idea. How can I make a film about my negativity? How can I make a film about being chronically single, et cetera, et cetera? Like, that doesn't make sense. That's a horrible idea. Okay, let me try. So 15 Reasons to Live just came out of this. It was just inspired by the challenge of a film structure challenge. And my great sort of disappointment with that film is I think I totally made it work. I think I totally discovered a way to overcome the challenge. So now I almost never get credit from anybody for, they don't even notice that it was a challenge because I did, I mean, I'm patting my own back here, but I did such a good job of defeating the challenge that I'm not even getting credit for taking on the challenge, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes. And the stories themselves, some of them are kind of vignettes and other ones are actual proper stories, narratives that have a beginning and an end, or at least an end point. And, you know, just getting back to the question that I was asking. So that was an interesting departure for you from the theme-based documentary to a more story narrative-driven documentary. And then, of course, you moved on to the Steve Fonio film Hurt, which is very much a story with an end point and a beginning. And so I'm wondering sort of how different it is working in a narrative-driven film compared to one that's interview-driven and theme-driven. And then, you know, is this leading us towards a return to narrative filmmaking?
Well, I will return to narrative filmmaking if I ever get it together to try to return to narrative filmmaking, which I'm not sure I ever will. And if I do it, I won't do it permanently. Like, you know, my first narrative film back, if it happened, would maybe happen 2 years from now. And it would have to be a massive hit beyond Canada, even. Like, not a massive hit like a real American Hollywood hit, but it would have to be a cause celeb, at the very least, for me to then transition into a career in fiction film at 66. Like, if I want to keep making films till I'm 80, I will have to make documentaries too. But it wouldn't be bad for me. It would be nice if there were like three fiction films or something that I could sort of add in there just for the experience and for the fun of expressing yourself in a different way. Though I don't think it's fair to say that because the films are more stories in a conventional way than the other films were, that therefore, I don't think there's really, well, I don't know. I don't think there's a strong connection. I think basically what happened was, I remember one of my best friends back in the early 90s saying to me something like, you're more a storyteller than a filmmaker. I literally remember just telling them, you know what, fuck off. And actually what they meant to say was more a storyteller than a visual filmmaker. And I sort of came to understand both sides of what he said. Number one, I don't like to say this, but I'm not a visual filmmaker in the sense that, you know, some people are. Like, some people definitely are, and I don't know what they're doing. And I don't even know how to imitate what they're doing, though I've tried to imitate what they're doing. So, you know, I like certain shots and I like certain framing and I think some things are beautiful and sometimes I try to do those things that are beautiful, but I'm not aware of how to use those visuals in some kind of overt way to tell the story. the other part of what that my friend said was that you're a storyteller. And I think I said this before, there was just a time when that word or even that concept offended me. And I really don't know why, but I guess it's just that the films I was thinking of making back then, there was something about them besides the story that I felt like I was trying to create. Even though I think possibly the filmmakers who I admired, whose films I was dedicated to, might have said, no, they're stories. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Cassavetes would have said Husbands is a story, or whether he would say, no, it's something inherently filmic that cannot be simply called a story. I think that's how I felt. Like, just the word story seemed almost like old-fashioned, and I didn't want to be associated with it. But when I started making these films, these documentaries, somehow the notion of being a storyteller, I sort of started to own it more. So anyway, the idea of a story and what a story is and how important stories are, it became almost like a religious calling to me that, like, we're in the world to tell each other our stories. And my job was to go to people who stories we don't usually hear, or who, you know, just don't have an opportunity to tell their story, and get them to tell their story so everybody who can relate to that, et cetera. So, yeah, I just started wanting to do stories more. And all the time that I was making those films with 100 people that I interviewed, I always thought, wouldn't it be nice if you just made a film about one person? And then you never have to wonder, like, what am I going to do next? Because you're just going to follow that person. And, you know, like, that would seem like a dream. It's like somebody suggested the Stefano story to me, and I thought about it. And a few years later, I did it. And it really was, you know, a dream come true in a lot of ways to have that experience, to make a film in a different way. Like, I never made a film like that. And it was, there was a sense in which, okay, now I'm making a proper movie. It might be my best film, and it might be my best film because maybe bringing all that I learned from those slightly strange films to bear on a film that is sort of a proper movie was, you know, sort of an unbeatable combination.
If finances were not an issue, now that you're in a relationship and now that you're raising a child, do you think that you would be able to make a film like A Vinyl or an I, Curmudgeon? You see what I mean? Psychologically, do you think you would be able to make such a film?
Yeah, I could. You know, like, I could make a film about what is going on in my life right now quite easily. The only thing that would stop me from making a film like that now is my wife would not want me to be as honest about her or things that involve her as I was about things that only involved me. But right now I'm in a very contemplative time. I mean, look, I think I said before, record collector, negative, invariably single, all that time. I could have made a film about smoking because I smoked my head off through all those films. But I definitely could have made a film about being fat or overweight or whatever you want to say. And I still am. And now I'm in this, I'm more serious about losing weight than I have been since, you know, 15 years ago. And I certainly could make a film about that. And I certainly could interview, you know, fat men and make that film. And I don't know. I think I, even though that sounds horrible because there's a lot of shows on TV about fat people, I bet I could make a film that transcends all that stuff now. I could do that, but I'm not going to.
I wish you would.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could make a Vinyl-like movie now about being fat or about, I could make one about being an old dad, although I think that's a bit of a cliche. I can make a documentary called Invisible about growing old and becoming invisible to the culture. I can make one about everything going on in my life now. Yeah, I could, and that would be fun. But I just don't think I'm going to, although I never say never. It's like, yeah, it's kind of self-indulgent, but yes, I would prefer to spend the rest of my life making films that really challenge me in a certain way that other films have in the past. But I can't afford to do that anymore. And so even if I do have to, like, churn them out, here it comes, Alan Dwight takes on circus clowns. You know, Alan Dwight takes on funeral directors. I hope that doesn't happen, but if it has to happen for my daughter to have a roof over her head, that's what I'll have to do.
How do you think that the process of making films and getting involved, you know, quite intimately with other people has affected you?
Well, I think that I haven't gotten involved intimately with other people as much as people think. There are interview subjects in Our Name who I met once, interviewed for an hour. Well, there's one I met once, interviewed twice for an hour, never saw again. The rest of them I did see afterwards and become friends with, but at the time I made it, what you're seeing is not a reflection of my intimate involvement with them. And, you know, it occurs to me that I should say this, which is when I made Vinyl, I just tried to interview as many people that collected records as I could. And I interviewed them once and I found them by just asking around or saying, hey, do you want to be in my film? And then some people would say, yeah, come this afternoon. And then I would come and I would spend an hour or so. I would try to spend at least an hour and then I'd leave and never see them again, some of them. And then basically the same thing happened with Ike Curmudgeon. Sometime around then, I heard some documentary filmmakers talking at a conference or something. And they said, well, what they do is they go out looking for subjects. They meet them without a camera. They spend maybe 6 months talking to these various ones until they know their story and know who they are and feel like they got their trust. And I thought, really? You could have knocked me over with a feather. It's like, that just sounded so weird to me. There was no way I could do that. Like, I meet somebody, I find them interesting. As soon as they start saying interesting shit, I'm like, where the fuck, you know, how come the camera's not here? You know, so then people ask me, like in A Hard Name, people are confessing the things, you know, you had such trust with them. And it's like, I always have to stop them. And it's like, I definitely didn't have their trust. Like, how could I have their trust? I just met them. So I don't know if the other people who do this thing do have their trust. All I know is that on the surface, those filmmakers who get trust aren't, I don't think, getting better stuff than I'm getting without their trust, having met them an hour ago. I feel like somehow I disarm people in some way that I never even really thought about what I'm doing. And they tell us things. I'm not sure they're telling us their deepest, darkest secret, but it's deep enough for me. And, you know, I always say that, give this example, which is that, you know, 6 out of the 7 people in Our Name talk about being sexually abused as children. You know, a couple of them, that was just part of what, how they talk. But one of them, Gord, that was not something that he talked about all the time. And when he talked about it in the film, I had asked him, you know, kind of an innocent question. You know, he was talking about people forgiving him, and I just asked him who are the people that he wants to forgive. I didn't think, oh, I'm asking a question about sexual abuse. But if I had known that Gord had been sexually abused in such a way by his father's friends, I have no idea how I would have asked that question. So I think that I have gotten some people to a place where they felt like telling some details. But it wasn't through any, you know, strategy, and it wasn't because I'm so easy to talk to. Or
maybe that's the reason why you've had such open responses from people. Maybe they're sensing a sympathy or at least an empathy instead of a journalistic technique.
Yeah, or maybe they're sensing that I'm not a journalist or not an interviewer. Like, I know that in one of the reasons things happened the way they did in A Hard Name is because I didn't have an agenda. Everybody that interviews ex-cons wants to know what they did. What was their crime? And they want to know, were you fucked in prison? And they want to know, do you feel bad? Or are you remorseful? And I didn't ask any of those questions. I mean, if you want to tell me about those things, that's fine. But anything you tell me is going to be interesting because I don't know anything like about prison or about crime or about court or about like anything. Tell me anything you want. You know, but that that's a privilege I had to be like that because I was making the kind of film I was making. If I was making a different kind of film where I really had to tell their story, I don't know how I would do it. But I was telling a film where any story you tell me is going to be cool. So as a result, sometimes they did tell me about those other things that I you know, were you sexually abused? Like, what a horrible question. Like, how would you get to that question? I mean, I have met interviewers in Canada who've interviewed me who are brilliant, and maybe they would have known how to, you know, gradually work their way up to asking whether they were sexually abused. But I'm not one of them. I'm not trained, and I just would never ask that. So on some level, people would say, well, by not asking those questions, you're missing opportunities to get those stories. And I would say, well, you're right, but I don't need those stories. I just need stories with, not even stories, sentences, utterances, with a feeling of, you know, spontaneity and truth. And if I miss, you know, that guy had a whole story. He was a serial killer. You missed the whole thing. Okay. Well, you go get that story.
You were saying that A Hard Name was the one that left the biggest effect on you. And how do you think it changed you? How do you think it developed you?
I think that, I don't know, it's hard to say. It's just like, I think it affected me the way it affected a lot of people who saw it, which was kind of, anything I would say feels banal, but something in that did affect me. That's all I can say is that I was sort of moved by those people, and it just made me feel different about what I do, even though I didn't then go on to make more films about subjects like that or social issues. In fact, I did the complete opposite, but still somehow that affected me. And then
it made you feel different about what you do. How? You mean it made you take it more seriously, or did you feel that you had more responsibility to actually make films like this?
Bits of what you said are in the ballpark. I think what it did is, on some level, it made me feel like there was some reason I had come to this, that there were aspects of my character that very much connected to the films I was making, and it wasn't as almost random as I thought of it. And made me feel like documentary could be a noble calling and stuff like that.
Now, let me ask you another thing. So your life was quite tough for a good 20 years or so.
Well, not like A Hard Name tough.
Not that tough, but your version of tough. But now it's sometime later. And from where you are standing now, would you change that at all? You know, those lean years that maybe you were angry about, do you maybe look at them now in a nostalgic way? Or do you have any kind of love towards that moment in your life, you know, when you were making that film about the record collecting or the person that you were in that moment?
Well, you know, regrets are stupid and you can't live your life again. And I don't think about that. Like, to be honest, if I could live my life again, I think I would, if I knew then what I knew now, I would just go back in time and tell the guy go to law school, because I'm not sure the world is a better place because I made these 7 films, and I'm not sure I wouldn't have been happier being a semi-successful lawyer with 4 kids and maybe being a patron of TIFF and going to movies and having some friend, making friends with filmmakers, or maybe even, you know, being their lawyer. Like, I wouldn't mind experiencing that. But otherwise, you know, after I'd been trying to make films for a while, I started to want something. It wasn't exactly fame, but it was, I wanted to be good and I wanted to be recognized as good, not by the world, but just by, you know, by other people, the way I looked at some of the people that were my inspirations. Obviously, I started to want that and I didn't know that I wanted it, but I wanted it. So this is embarrassing for me to tell this, but I'm going to anyway. Last April, I went with my wife and my producer and his wife to the Canadian Screen Awards, which is, I don't want to call it the Canadian Oscars because that would overplay it. And now I was up for Hurt, which to my shock, I won. And later in the hallway, I ran into a filmmaker a few years older than me, but who had been successful early in the years that I was unsuccessful. He's a bit of a sort of patron saint indie filmmaker in Canada. And I'd met him once at some conference or something. And he came up to me and he said, you know, like, you remember me? And I said, oh, yeah, of course I remember you. And then he said, I've been following your career, and I think you're a great filmmaker. And you know what? I could have died right then. That was like, you could have killed me then.
I wonder whether we could say that there are reasons to be thankful for the way things have worked out.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I mean, sometimes this is a weird way of looking at things, but sometimes when I feel like things haven't worked out enough, or I feel a little jealous of somebody who's had more success, I say, okay, take Alan in 1992. Look at Alan now. Would you be jealous? Fucking jealous. I don't know why I have to resort to such a twisted negative emotion to have that feeling, but that's true. I have succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. One of the biggest film festivals in the world is in my backyard, and I have done pretty well in that festival, but not in any of the other giant film festivals. But whatever, if I lived in Cannes and every 2 years I had a film that did really well in Cannes, I wouldn't really care that I didn't get into the Indiana Film Festival. I don't quite understand why my films haven't traveled, but often I finish a film and like 3 weeks later, in the case of Hurt, I'm standing before, 1,300 people there. It's almost unfathomable. But not even that. I've had people come up to me and say things. People have said lovely things about what the film's meant to them. And yeah, you know, I feel like I'm being so, you know, narcissistic when I say this, but I just feel like film is a culture that's been really important to me. There's been many directors who I had feelings for, many films that moved me. To be part of that is, you know, that and my daughter, that's what I live for.
Thank you for downloading this episode of DocPod. For more information about Alan Zweig and other filmmakers, please visit us at thedocpod.net.